Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and I'm so excited to share with you this episode and the content that we got for you as myself and my partner in crime, Martin Slam Duncan, from the Fastball Special, recently reached out to one of our favorite comic book creators in the industry today, Mr. Matt Kent himself. And for those who may not be familiar with the works of Matt Kent, fear not, because after this episode, you will be very familiar with his stuff, because we go into quite a bit of detail of the books that he's worked on and is currently working on now, and we get a real good sense of the context and perspective of some of his inspirations and creative choices when he's producing his stories. He does a lot of things that he makes great use of the entire comic book page, especially in his creator-owned stuff. It was great to be able to take the time to talk to him and pick his brain, along with my co-host, Mr. Slam Duncan, who I got to give a special shout out to because he held down the fort during a portion of this interview, because as you'll hear, I lost connection 2/3 into our conversation over Skype, which is, of course, a ton of fun to have happen to you. Yeah, the beauty of technology, right? Well, besides all that, after you listen to this episode, I strongly urge you to go and check out Matt Kent's books, and a great place to do that is a comic shop near me, Cyber City Comics, 1025A Steeles Avenue West. And if you don't live in the GTA, I strongly urge you to go to your local comic book shop, wherever you are, and grab these books with Matt Kent in the credits, because you will not be disappointed. It's well worth your money. It's the way comic books should and could be made today. Whether it's his creator-owned things from Dark Horse Comics or Valiant Entertainment, pick something up with Matt's name on it, and you will not be disappointed. So without further ado, the Cave of Solitude and the Fastball Special proudly bring to you our conversation with Matt Kent. It is our pleasure to be joined by one of the most prolific, talented storytellers in comics today. He has done work on Marvel and DC books, but more importantly, he is the creator of books such as the renowned Mind Management, what seems like the entire line of Valiant Comics right now, as well as his current story published by Dark Horse Comics, Department H. It's none other than the incomparable Matt Kent. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt. And seeing as you are writing and drawing so many great books, I won't hold it against you if you're working on something right now.
Yeah, no, I gotta go. I'll see you later. Stressed me out. The introduction stressed me out.
too much critical acclaim, I guess. Well, you deserve it.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess with all that said, the first thing I want to ask is, with all these books that you're working on, how are you able to compartmentalize and keep everything organized? Because that's incredible. When I look at all the things I'm reading that have Matt Kent at the top of the credits page, it boggles my mind. How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key, is just to keep everything in its own little compartment, you know? So it's a lot like reading a book, you know? Like, if you can read two books at the same time, it's sort of the same thing, where you read a book and you enter that universe and you're in it and you're inhabiting that space and those characters, and then you enjoy that book. And then, you know, so say you read that one in the morning, or you read that one today, and then tomorrow you pick up a different book, and then you just sort of enter that reality and enjoy that. So I feel like it's kind of the same. It's just, instead of reading it, you know, if you can read two or three books at the same time, it's the same thing. It's writing is kind of like you're just inhabiting that world and sort of dreaming about it and coming up with stuff. And it's kind of the same thing, I guess.
Is there ever a day when you're working on Ninjak or EXO, for instance, and all of a sudden a great idea for Department H comes through, and you scrap everything you're doing, or are you able to stay focused on just being with Eric of Dacia?
Yeah, hardly ever. I guess, you know, my head is all in that one space, so there's hardly ever a crossover or anything like that. I mean, I think the toughest time I ever had was a couple of years ago. It was one summer where I was writing a book for Marvel, a book for DC, and then I had started stuff for Valiant. And I was laying in bed at night thinking about whatever. I don't know what the story was. It was Suicide Squad or something. And then I was like, oh, which? And I started to get mixed up. I was like, is it S.H.I.E.L.D. that's going to come in? Or is it Gate, which is a Valiant thing? And then DC has their Argus or whatever. So I was like, oh. I was getting my S.H.I.E.L.D. My S.H.I.E.L.D.'s mixed up.
unintentional crossover.
Yeah.
That was too much. I realized that was too much. I'm going to bed at night thinking about which is which, and I need to cut down on how many books I'm writing.
That's hilarious. That would be an editor's dream, right? To see Argus in a Marvel book.
Yeah, right. Hopefully it didn't happen. Ideally, the editor edited that out.
So Matt, do you find a big difference between working on some of your creator-owned books versus stuff from DC or Valiant? Is there a big difference from you, or is the process kind of similar?
Yeah, I would say there's a big difference between doing something with DC versus my creator-owned stuff, but with Valiant and the little bit of Marvel stuff I did, sort of gave me free rein too. There's really no difference. You know, the only difference is it's a character that's pre-existing. And so you kind of go in with respect for the history of that character that you don't necessarily have to have with your own creator own books. But yeah, I would say it was with Valiant, you know, I do as much as I do for them because they don't come back with a lot of notes or a lot of of the BS of stuff that, you know, that isn't part of the story or something to help the story. They just kind of let you, if you're telling a good story, they let you tell it, you know, without any interference.
So it
makes it super easy because there's not a lot of revisions, you know, I don't have to go back and change things to accommodate some other ridiculous, like a movie that's getting made or something like that. Right. You know? It's a lot easier.
So, yeah, I'd always thought that, you know, there a lot of these companies are very protective of their brand, so I thought they might be very specific on what they allow you to do, but you're saying they're fairly open.
Yeah, they are, and honestly, Valiant is such a new universe to play in that a lot of it is just they want me to sort of populate it with, you know, stuff. So there's not a lot of there's a few key iconic like villains and things, but there's still a lot of room and a lot of things that they need. So it's part of the fun of that is kind of being on the ground floor of this other universe that isn't fully grown yet and helping to grow it, you know, and come up with new villains and populate it with new characters and have I think that's with Divinity, that was a big opportunity, to just come up with a new iconic character that hadn't existed before. And then spinning out of that were like a whole another group of characters from the Stalinverse thing. There were a bunch of Russian characters that came back. It's just fun to sort of get to play or pretend like I'm Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, you know, sort of
yeah.
And come up with some of these new characters, you know.
It's awesome. So I wanna take it from the beginning, Matt. On your website, it's quoted there saying that seriously, you have the best job ever. So obviously you've got a deep love and appreciation for the comic book medium. So can you take us back a little bit to your comic book origin, what your earliest memories of comics are and what titles you loved or what you loved about them initially?
Yeah, I had an older brother, he's 6 years older than me, so he was buying comics. He was buying his first books were like X-Men when Jean Grey was dying, you know, the Dark Phoenix saga. Nice. He's buying those that came out. Yeah, and I was like, wow, what is that? What are you reading? And he was so into it. And he had all those issues like stacked up on a shelf in his closet, you know, sort of hidden from me. And I'd sneak in there and then he'd get mad. And he's like, I can tell you're reading my comics because they're out of order. I was like, and this is bad. We lived in a small town, so there was no comic shop. There was just a grocery store with a spinner rack.
Right.
And so you get rows on the spinner rack. And then I subscribed to comics, you know, through the ads in the back. So I got my first subscription was Daredevil, which is right at the end of the Frank Miller run. And then what else did I have? G.I. Joe and Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. I was definitely a Marvel kid growing up. know, just because that's what my brother was reading. And then later I'd find the DC books, and I like those too, just because they're sort of weird, kind of seem like weird sort of off-brand versions of the Marvel characters that I liked, you know. And that sounds terrible, but I liked it. I liked that they were kind of off.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't know why. And so I was reading that stuff, you know. And by the time I got to college, I was making comics at home and drawing, learning to draw off of comics and writing and just all kinds of. I didn't know what to do with all of it, you know. I was like, I really like drawing, I really like writing. I don't know how this is going to come together. And you know, in hindsight, it's easy to be like, oh, well, duh, comic books, you can write and draw. But at the time, you know, in that era too, there weren't a lot of cartoonists that were writing and drawing stuff. So I didn't really know what to do. And by the time I got out of high school, I was like, well, I'm kind of sick of superhero books. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm probably just going to write, or I'm going to draw, but probably write. What did I pick up? I was at a convention in Chicago, and 8-Ball, the first few issues of 8-Ball had come out, and I found those. And I was reading those on the way home in the car, and I just had this revelation. I was like, oh, this is, here's some comics that aren't superheroes, but they're still weird, and there's some genre stuff, and action, and they're neat, but it's different kinds of stories. And I thought, well, this is kind of what I want to do. I want to tell stories that aren't sort of Spider-Man or Daredevil or any of that stuff. I want to tell crime stories or mysteries or just like weird, just something weird, you know?
Yeah.
And so then when that hit me right when I entered art school. And so I was drawing, learning how to draw, learning how to paint, taking creative writing classes, and sort of just trying to figure out what my comics were going to be, you know? And then I figured, well, the stuff I want to do, Marvel and DC aren't going to publish it. I'll just have to do it on my own. And so I did. I did like probably, how many pages, maybe 200 or 300 pages of like mini comics that I would just print and self-publish and drag to comic shops. And they're all terrible, you know. I'll be honest, you know, but it was necessary, you know, to figure out how to do it, you know, just like churning out pages to figure out how they work or how to make comics.
Learning your craft. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I still have a box of them. I literally just saw a box of them downstairs in my basement this morning. I was cleaning something up and I still have them. So I'm trying not to let those get out. I don't want people to see it.
Yeah, you'd probably want to Harvey or Eisner for those stuff nowadays, the stuff you did once before.
Yeah.
So was there anything else that piqued your interest or influenced your creative sensibilities, even like down till today, from when you were young, outside of comic books?
Yeah, for sure. I was always reading. So I would go through these phases, you know, high school through college, and I was reading. Like, I read tons of Doc Savage, and I read through all the Ian Fleming's James Bond books, and then I just loved all genre fiction. And then I read tons of sci-fi, Asimov and Clark, and then found Philip K. Dick, which was, like, probably my favorite stuff, you know? And so I've read most of his stuff, and just everything, you know? What else? I'm trying to think of, but yeah, mostly books, mostly fiction. Like, J.D. Salinger, I love a lot, you know? And I read a bunch of his stuff. Most of his, he didn't have very many books, but I recommend all of them. And then I got, what else have I read? I like Nabokov is one of my favorites. I think he's a great writer. And so just, I think just tons of reading, you know, informs my stuff as much as anything. But yeah, and I think the older I got, the less I read comics and the more I was just reading everything else and trying to read nonfiction and doing research. And at this point, I probably do more research and nonfiction reading than anything else.
Ian Fleming, I knew it.
they're just like you could tell he was a travel writer because that was part I liked was like he was taking you to these locales and like the location was as important as anything, you know. And if there's anything, that's a lesson I learned is like when I'm sitting down to write any comic, it's always like. Well, where is it? You know, where is this taking place? That's the most fun part to figure out.
So I was actually going to ask you about that. So I actually follow you on Facebook, and I noticed recently that you were in Italy. I was actually in Italy the week before.
And
I was in Florence and I was in Rome. And it's so funny because I was posting sort of the same, or you were posting the sort of the same pictures that I were about a week later, like the Colosseum and the Pantheon, and almost shot for shot the same shots.
That's funny. And I was trying not. I was trying to post weird ones, you know, like everybody posted the same one. So I was trying to post stuff that was a little different.
It's really funny. I'll send you a couple because you'll see that they're very similar. But my question around that was do you ever, like when you go traveling and you see these sites, do you ever incorporate that into your work?
Yeah, always. You know, and it's not even a conscious thing. I think we enjoy traveling, and so we go to a lot of places, and then and sometimes I'll go with a mission, like I want to go here because I know it's going to inspire me for whatever project. And other times I'll go somewhere and then it won't hit me till later when I'm writing, something will sort of creep into a story or a location or something I saw, you know, will give me an idea. But yeah, I think a lot of inspiration just comes from that, you know, and that's why my favorite part of Department H is being able to, use trips to Hawaii as a tax write-off for research. You know, probably the smartest book I've ever done.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
They're all going to be in sunny, warm places. Or
it's like, well, I gotta go snorkeling, gotta see the beach.
This one's set in the Bahamas. Yeah. So what? So you've done.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
I think I got a lag. Go ahead, Martin. Sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. So I was going to say, you've read a lot of these novels. I could definitely, based on your the list that you just gave us, I could definitely see some of those influences. And so what character that you haven't worked on that you'd love to get your hands on, any medium that you sort of have a story in your head and you'd love to say it, I'd love to tell it?
That's funny. Hey, I honestly don't think about fictional characters. I don't really daydream about them. I don't know if that's weird. I don't know if that's weird or not. If somebody asked me to do, like, I never really thought about what I would do with Spider-Man. When Marvel asked me to do it, I was like, oh, well, what would I do? And then, and that's fun to do it, but I don't really do that on my own. I feel like I just, like my heart is really with the creator owned stuff.
Right.
And so I don't really daydream about that at all. I think with the Valiant books, it's a little different, you know, because there's a lot of characters that they haven't really done something with yet. So I'll sort of think about that, you know, and I think, Shadow Man is one of those characters that he's been used a little bit, and I'm like, oh, what would I do? You know? So I've sort of toyed around with that a little bit. And so that's probably the closest I've gotten to it. But otherwise I'm trying to come up with like weird story ideas all the time that aren't really a character specific. It's almost more like ideas I want to try to get on paper or into a book or thoughts, you know? I think one of the, I have a couple of things in the works I'm doing. I don't want to talk about them because they're not talking about stuff that I haven't finished yet. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things in the works that, I've been wanting to do for a while, but there's a couple of real people that I want to use in books that I'm going to be working on in the next couple of years.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome. So when you said before you do research on these characters, and obviously you need to do that in order to make the story legitimate and to make even people who are knowledgeable about the things you're talking about show that this guy knows what he's writing. But when you get into a character, let's say like Shadow Man, and it gets so dark and you get to all these nether regions, do you ever get frightened by some of the research that you have to do with certain characters?
Yeah, I don't know if I get frightened, but I really did dive into some Shadow Man stuff, and I did a bunch of research on like voodoo and its origins and everything, and I thought that was really interesting, you know, like I love doing the research on like the evolution of like beliefs, you know, religions and magic and that kind of thing, and how those beliefs start out as something real and then over time they sort of evolve into into something that becomes a thing, but not necessarily something people believe in anymore. So that was fun. I did a ton of research on Shadow Man, which I'm probably not going to ever use. But it's still fun. That's the most fun to me. Like, they're preparing for a book or series or story. The most fun is actually doing, like, visiting a location in real life or reading the history of it. I think that's the fun part. And that's kind of, that ends up being where the ideas come from anyway, is like, real life or even fiction. Like, when I'm reading fiction, I love reading a story where, and this is why I don't recommend books to anyone, because when I'm reading a book, I'm judging it by different criteria. I don't judge it by, is it a good book or not, you know, but I judge it by kind of like how many ideas it gives me. And I'll be reading, you know, and it's not like the idea is in the book, but it's like, I'll be reading something. And then it's like, oh, I think they're going to go one way with it and do this thing. And then you turn the page and they've done something else and it's maybe not as good or different. And it's like, oh, well, I should have done this other thing, you know, but that's not, there's an idea I can store and use later, you know, that wasn't there, but now it is. I don't know. It's, and honestly, I'm telling you this stuff, like, this is how I work. Every single book, every story, and almost every issue I write is a completely different process, like in a frustrating way. But it's like, sometimes I have it right away. Sometimes I have to write it backwards or start with an ending. It's always different. Yeah,
absolutely. Let me ask you about Dark Horse for a second.
When working with Dark Horse, a lot of people who nowadays are doing independent or creator-owned things, it seems that they always go to Image. That's the place to go to. You've done Mind Management as well as that now Department H with Dark Horse. What is the difference as far as publishing between the two, and why did you choose to go with Dark Horse?
I think I've been with Dark Horse for a while. The first book they published was Three Story back in, I don't know what year it was, but years ago. And then when Mind Management was, when that first started coming out, I had shopped it around, and a lot of publishers were like, well, we're not doing monthly books. We're not doing series. We only want to do graphic novels. And so I was like, well, okay. Mind Management only works as a series for me. It's the only way I wanted to do it. And I took it to Dark Horse, and they basically gave me a blank check. You know, it's like, do what you want. You know, you want ads in the back, you want to do your own fake ads, or you want to do, you know, they were willing to do that series exactly how I wanted, which is
cool.
Which was super weird, because they, like, structurally, like, nothing had been done like it. You know, I was doing ads in the back that looked like real ads that weren't. And then for a series of six issues, we actually, I had the idea to sell ads in the back to different retailers and things that we actually used as real ad, but with the caveat that I would design the ads, so they tied into the story. But we actually sold them. So sometimes they were real ads, and then just the structure of it and the format and the design, like there was zero interference, you know? And I think after that I was like, well, it was successful enough, and they've been willing to do anything I want to do. So like, I didn't really know why I needed to go anywhere else. And also,
right.
So a lot of it's just personal relationships too. You know, like Brendan was my editor on the book. I really loved him. Mike Richardson has always been really good to me, you know? And so I feel like, you know, they like what I do. I like how they treat my books, and there's no need to move around so much. That's the key. The key is, like, will you let me do exactly what I want?
So getting a little bit into Mind Management. So to confess, I actually just read the first book last night. around midnight, so I was a little sleepy, and I read the first book. Loved it, by the way. But one of the things that struck me, it was a few things that struck me, but I was about 20 pages in, and I first noticed the border around the panel.
Yeah.
And I had thought originally it was just an artistic choice to leave the border, and they were just regular panels, and then I read it, and it really pulled me in. So I guess what was the choice behind having those I guess those little field memoirs on those blue panels. Was that something you wanted to do from the beginning? Is this something that came later?
Yeah, I think the origin of the idea was I was designing the first issue, and I was putting the pages in Photoshop, and then I just scanned in like blue lines.
Yeah,
the artist, the paper that like Marvel or DC supplies you to draw on, and it has all the blue lines and the guides on it. And so I scanned it in as just like as a guide to size my art, you know, because I don't draw on that, but I needed it to use as a guide. And then it was in there. I was like, oh, it looks kind of neat with just the blue, the type and the lines on there. It looks kind of cool. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just leave it. But then all the words on the side were kind of dumb. It was just, you know, they were what the like, you know, this is where the bleed is. This is the trim. This is the, and then there's all these directions, instructions on it. I was like, well, what if the instructions were different?
Right.
And so I wrote one and I was like, well, that's cool. But then that's dumb to have it on 24 pages the same. I was like, well, what if every page was different, you know? And sort of just that first issue when I was putting it together, the idea came to me to just put a little text on every page that was different. And I thought, well, I'll do it for the first arc. That'll be fun. But then people liked it so much that I was like, well, now I'm roped into doing it all the time, where people are lazy and don't want to do it anymore, which is totally true. I didn't want to do it after the first six. I was like, well, I don't want people to think I'm lazy. And this book, to me, that book was about pouring everything I had into it, every idea, using every inch of it. And so I did, and it was probably my least favorite part of making the comics. But I think in the grand scheme of things, I figured out a way to do it. So like you'll see when you get to the later books, the text is still there, but it serves different purposes as you go along, depending on what arc it is. And I think it really helped it helped make the reader more of an active participant in the book, because you're reading the stuff that's not between the panels, you know, it's not on the cutter, it's on the edges, you know? So I feel like it makes you an active, participant, you know, you got to rotate the book or whatever you're sitting on it and then read it.
I got to tell you, like when I discovered it, I feel like I really discovered something that no one else did at that time. And it was actually pretty exciting because it was one of those things. I'm reading along and I'm enjoying the story. And then all of a sudden, what is this? and then I start flipping back through the book and I knew I was onto something special. So I think that effect definitely worked on me, because I felt that now I'm engaged in this experience, different than a regular comic book.
Yeah, and there's certain pages too when you read what's happening on the I want of what Matt's trying to tell us with this specific event that's taking place. So I appreciated it.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's fun, and the more I did them, the more subversive they got, because I was kind of tired of doing them. So I was like, well, okay, you know. But then it was fun. I was able to give pages like double meanings, you know, and add some subtext that might not have been there otherwise.
Yeah, it gives it a rereadability as well. Like, you can go back a second time, read the book, and just read those portions. Make sure you read them all, and it adds so much more context a second time, which a lot of books don't have that, right? You read it once, you got what you needed, but this one, there's going to be all added information, which is great.
Yeah, for sure.
So as you read along in the story, there are these, I guess, extraordinary humans that have these talents. You know, in other publications, they might call them mutants, metahumans, etc. But did you have a specific reason in mind in this world as to how they became, or is it just that they were just born this way and they were discovered through this mind management?
Yeah, no, there's like an unwritten rule for me when I was doing the book, and it was to just try to take something that I thought may be possible and then just sort of like turn up the dial a little bit, you know? So just like the basic idea of like mind over matter, or like holistic healing and that kind of thing, where your brain's control over your body, you know? And I think a lot of that, I do actually believe, you know, not to the degree that it's in mind management, but I think that you, your outlook on life and how you feel about and think about things definitely can physically affect you. You know, it can make you feel worse or feel better physically. So just honestly, I think I was just taking that and just trying to juice it up, you know, maybe turn it up a lot more, but within the grounds of a reality based thing that just, or like a base reality where it's like, okay, if you can do this, well, what if you took this mind over your body and maybe having positive thoughts to make yourself feel better, cure your sick stomach or something. Well, what if you could heal a gunshot wound?
Sure.
You know, how much further is that? Well, it's a lot further, but for a comic, I think it needed that, you know, it's something a little bit over the top. But so everything I thought was sort of based on that, you know, and some of the stuff like the remote imaging and things like that were things that the government actually experimented with. The United States government did, where they were training, they would put people in these rooms and try to train them to do remote imaging and try to imagine what these rooms were halfway across the world and that kind of thing. So they were trying to do that stuff. So part of it was also that, just like, well, I don't think that any of that really worked, but what if it had, you know, and then just sort of create a world based on that.
And the mind management themselves, it's a little bit, at least in my mind, it was a little bit ambiguous in terms of, are these actually, is this actually the government or is this a separate group? Is that sort of revealed or is it supposed to be a certain way?
Yeah, you get to it, you know, the bigger theme is what is this group? What is their responsibility? You know, are they reporting to one government? Are they responsible for the well-being of the entire Earth? Mm. You know, and I don't know if you got to the part yet where there's the library and the monks.
Yes,
but that's a big part of it too. Is just this idea that there's this library where all the truth exists. You know, you can pick out a book off the shelf and it will tell you exactly what happened. You know, you want to know what happened in November 1963? Take that book off the shelf and look at it. And there was a monk that was there witnessing everything and writing it down. So you could sort of know what happened. And I love that sort of repository of absolute truth that exists. And they're kind of the guardians of that, which is something I've always, like, to me, that's my idea of like heaven. So, you know, you die and you go to heaven. And it's like, well, what I want to know, these are the things I want to know, or it's not heaven. If I don't get to know who killed JFK and the other conspiracies, if I don't get to know the true truth of that, then I don't think that's heaven. So part of that is my idea of that, sort of played out in the real world.
And that's very interesting because I don't know if everybody would want to know everything. You know,
oh my gosh, that's one of my things I want to know more than anything. It's just, I want to know everything.
I totally get that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that, and that's one of the bigger themes that runs through the book is this idea that there's this big organization that's trying to protect truth and make good in the world. But then the bigger the organization gets, I feel like the more corruption creeps in, you know, which is another theme in there where it's like you get two people together, everything's going to be good, but you get three or four people together, then you got, you're going to get people that are selfish or egotistical or have maybe not the needs of the many, outweighing the needs of the few kind of thing going on, you know, so it's, and that's another one of the themes that sort of runs through the book. And how do you deal with that?
So seeing as vast as so far what I've read in mind management, all the places the characters are traveling and how fast paced it's moving, did you make a conscious effort when you moved on to Department H that you wanted it to be more of a simpler locale or things to be contained in a certain setting so it wouldn't be as fast paced or as needing to come up with so many more ideas as far as where people were going?
Yeah, definitely it was a reaction to mind management, you know, and that with mind management, my goal was to sort of create a series where I could go anywhere, tell any story in any time, you know, and just sort of have like a big canvas to work on, you know, and have, I had a big idea for a story, but within that, I wanted to be able to do, tell these smaller stories and fill it with whatever came to me at the time. Which is kind of, I always feel like Sandman is the perfect, yeah, it's the ideal series, you know, where he set up these characters and this idea and this world where he could kind of tell any story he wanted to tell, depending on what mood he was in them. And I always respected it for that because I'm like, this is, it's a creator's dream, you know? It's like, well, we have this brand with a title, but within that, then you can tell anything or do any kind of story. And so that was the goal of my management. But then after that, it was so exhausting that I kind of wanted to break from it. And I also thought it would be more, also just as much of a challenge to have a series that takes place in sort of one room, one location, you know, 10 characters and that's it.
Right.
And you just don't leave them, you know, for the whole series. Which ends up being a lot harder than my management was, you know, just because you are so much more confined. There's a smaller box you have to work with, you know. So it's a little bit harder, I think, in the long run.
So you actually just mentioned the 10 characters in Department H. So was that on purpose? Is that sort of a play on the 10 Little Indians? Agatha Christie? Yeah.
Christie was definitely an inspiration, you know. Like, I remember when I was a kid, my mom loved Agatha Christie. The books were everywhere, and she read them all the time. And I didn't really read them until I was preparing for this series. I'm like, well, I better read some, you know, because I'm not a big fan of whodunit mysteries. I feel like those books, and I'd probably read one or two Agatha Christie's, or I'd seen the movies, you know, I saw Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah.
And so I get it. I get those, but I also feel like the books are driven by the idea of finding out who did it, or, you know, you're trying to figure it out the whole time, and then at the end you find out. But I feel like those books, they don't have a lot of readability, you know, like as much as mind management is a ton of stuff and then you want to go back and reread it, I feel like I don't want to do a book where you're reading it just to find out who did it, and then when you find it out, then you never pick it up again. So I was trying to figure out how to do a book that has the whodunit, and it checks that box, and there's a reveal, but it's more than that, so you might want to go back and reread it again. While Agatha Christie is an inspiration, I'm trying to do something a little different, or something that's more satisfying to me personally. You know, she's a master of the craft, et cetera, et cetera. I totally give her all that credit. I wanted to create something that you'd want to maybe go back and look at it again.
So the underwater setting, it definitely has that claustrophobic feel about it. The question is, why underwater? Is there a specific reason? Is it because you're a fan of other, like The Abyss? And it reminded me of a few things like The Abyss and movies and films like this, with that sort of claustrophobic, feeling, and then not knowing again who this killer is.
Yeah, I think I'm scared of drowning. So that's the first big inspiration. I think it's like my one fear. I don't like spiders and I don't want to drown. anything else. Like, I think I could take getting bitten by a snake. I would take that all right. So I think that was kind of the inspiration. It was like, well, what's the scariest thing for me? And I think being underwater like that, sort of trapped, is terrifying. And then, I like drawing underwater stuff, you know. I like drawing with the creatures and the coral and all the things that are down there, and water is fun. I love drawing submarines. I love a good cross section, so if I can draw stuff underwater that's got cross sections, like as far as fun things to draw, I think that was probably the second biggest reason why I did it.
So actually, I was going to ask you that question, because both being both the writer and drawer, or inker and drawer, does that ever affect the way you're writing a story? So I want to draw this, so I'm going to write this in the story just because I want to draw this, or I don't really want to draw this scene, so I'm going to take that out of the story.
Definitely. I would say 100%. Yes. there are going to be no horses in any story that I write for myself to draw. But I also don't like cars either. But I do the next one of the next books I'm working on is and maybe this is just like a, I don't know why I'm doing this to myself, but I it's gonna just have tons of cars in it because I hate drawing them. I thought what better way to learn to draw cars than to have a story that's got tons of cars in it, and crashing and shooting and like action. So I think that's one of the next books I'm going to be working on. Run right at it, you know, instead of like avoiding it all the time like I do, I'll run right at something I hate drawing.
So this is a creator-owned book?
What's that?
This would be a creator-owned book?
Yeah, a creator-owned book.
So you can only blame yourself, really.
Yeah. Horrible writer. It won't be horses in it. I don't like horses.
I've heard that before. A lot of artists say they hate drawing cars and they hate drawing horses. Why is there something? I heard Neil Adams say once that he drawing a horse was one of the most difficult things. Especially there was one that he had to draw a horse laying down that it had died, and it was like a Western cover. What's the deal with hating horses?
Man, their anatomy is so weird. A friend of mine was telling me, they're like, look at it. It looks like it's like the strangest alien. Like if you pretend you don't know what a horse is and you look at it, they're so strange. Like the legs are backwards, the weird head. Yeah, but in real life, I love horses, though. They're beautiful creatures.
Just don't want to draw them. I guess that's why Beta Ray Bill made such a good alien-looking character, right? He looked like a horse.
He's a freaking horse.
There you go.
Yeah.
So in Department H, there wasn't the detail on the side of the pages the way they are in Mind Management, but I do notice that the water levels are rising with each issue. So is that – I counted up to 18. Are you planning on 18 issues? Because I know you don't like calling your shot of how many issues you're going to put in a book. But is that kind of an indication of how close we are to the – where we are in the story?
It might be. I'll say that. Water is rising, but it could also go down again. Who knows?
Okay.
Just probably, check. Yes.
Nice. Department H as well. So you were actually working with your wife on this project. So how's that?
Yeah, it's great. It's like it's been a long time coming. You know, we met in art school, and I was doing comics, but everything I was doing was in black and white. She was really good at watercolors. She was just painting all the time, and so I was like, how do you do that? And so she basically taught me how to do watercolor. You know, while we were in school, because we didn't have watercolor classes in art school. We learned oil painting and drawing and different medium. And I think we might have messed around with watercolors, but not in a way where I could be good at it, you know. But just watching her and having her show me some things over the years, I learned it. And she never really, like before I met her, she wasn't really into comics. And I was like, well, read this, read that, you know, like every guy that has a girlfriend that doesn't read comics, you know, you try to get her.
Yeah. Myself as well.
Yeah. You did. I would pick out things that she would like, but as a medium, I don't think she would read it unless I gave her something. But over the years, we've been doing it so long, and she's been supporting me and helping me, you know, behind the scenes for years and years, you know, since I started. And I was... Every once in a while, I'll be like, oh, we should collaborate. We should do something. She's like, well, I don't know. And then this one came up. I was like, why not watercolor it? You know, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's a perfect story for it because I think it lends itself to watercolor. And I was really burned out after Mind Management. I'm like, it was important for me when I was doing Mind Management that I do every single thing myself. Like I lettered it. I did all the coloring. I did the production. Like if it's on the page, it's something I did. Because I wanted to do, I always felt like that was one of the big crowning achievements in comics was when Dave Sim did his huge run of Cerebus. Monthly Forever. I was like, well, what can I do? I want to beat that somehow. I don't want to do it for 10 years, however long it took him, 10, 15 years. And also he had an assistant. You know, Gerard was doing the inks or backgrounds. And so I was like, well, what if I do? I'll do 24 pages, full color, and I do every single thing for 3 years. And that, I feel like that will at least tie it if it doesn't beat it. It's at least as good.
you don't make things easy on yourself at all.
Yeah, I'm glad for punishment.
There's a weird, I set these weird challenges for myself just because I think it'll be fun. And then after that 3 years, I was so burned out. I was like, I need a break from everything, you know? But it definitely cured me of that idea of wanting to do every single inch of every comic myself. So I think I was ready to collaborate, and then she was ready. And so it just worked out, you know? And I have Marie, who is a student of mine. She shares a studio with me now. I asked her to do lettering on it. And so I'm really branching out and working with others.
So you're letting go a little bit.
It's great. And I was a little bit horrible to work with at the beginning, but I didn't, and I've tried to get better, you know, but my wife Charlene's really great and she knows what she's doing. So eventually I figure out if the less I say, the better, you know, and just let her do her thing. It's just, when I do that, the pages turn out better because she knows how to do it.
So do you get influenced at all by that style, or even your wife telling you that she doesn't want to particularly paint something, or do you separate that and just go ahead and write your story and that's what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I'll run stuff by her like I've done my whole life, you know. I'll be like, oh, what do you think about what, if I'm not sure on something? But I think there was a little bit of a learning curve on Department H at the beginning. I really wanted to be claustrophobic. Yeah. And so I was doing lots of heavy blacks and not leaving much to be colored. And then I would open it up every once in a while. And I think if anything, I've tried to be more conscious of leaving areas for her to do her thing. And so I think as we've gone on, it's gotten better just because I'm like, oh, well, it's just, these are pages. Here's a sequence where I don't have to fill it with a ton of lines, or I don't have to fill it with a bunch of black. Because the color can tell the story, you know? And so I've been, I don't know how many issues it took. It probably took me 10, 12 issues to figure it out, but ways to leave areas for her to do her thing, you know, and then let her make the page or do some of the heavy lifting on the art, you know? And I think it turns out better. Like when the lines and the drawing work with the color rather than just being colored by the color, I think that's why you collaborate, you know, is to make something better than one or the other by itself.
I gotta say, when I look at the Dark Horse hardcovers that you put out, there's something about your packaging that I feel separates it from the other books that are on the shelf. Like Department H, I look at it, it's like a movie poster. And Mind Management, when I saw it in the store, I felt like there was an importance to reading it. Is there something specific in your choices of how you package these things that is very purposeful, or how much control are you having over that?
Yeah, I think when I got out of school, I was a graphic designer for 3 or 4 years. That was like my day job. And so I think in terms of design rather than comic books, especially for covers, I'm super sensitive to how they look. And I really hate a comic book that looks like a comic book. You know, and it took me a while to figure out that balance too, where a lot of my early books, I was designing the covers, but it wasn't really indicative of the art that was inside. You know, there were interesting covers, but it didn't look like what was inside. And I think over time I sort of figured that out, is like, how to make a cover that looks like a good design, just no matter what it is, and then also is indicative of like the art that's inside or what kind of what's going on in there. But yeah, it's the design is, I feel like it's 50% of the book, you know, just, you got to get somebody to pick it up. Yeah. So if it looks like it's another book on the shelf, no one's going to, you know, you're probably going to skip over it because it doesn't have spider or man in the title.
I mean, I was a sucker for those my whole childhood, right? I'd go and yes. pick up a comic because it had a great cover, and then I'd read it, and yeah. It had nothing to do with the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's a lot of those Neil Adams were like that.
Yeah,
exactly. But so I think when I'm doing the covers, I picture a wall, and somebody posted a picture on Twitter a couple months ago, and it was the whole wall of comics. And that's what I picture every time I'm doing a cover, because I picture 100 comics all next to each other with the thing I'm doing, you know. And it's like, how do you stand out from that, you know? And I think that's, if anything, that drives what the cover ends up being, you know, is just trying to stand out in a sea of like 100 covers.
So moving on to Valiant, were you a fan of the original Valiant line? Was it coming out at the sweet spot when you were collecting or reading comics in, as a teenager or a young adult?
Yeah, it was. That was right in the same area where I was getting sick of superhero books. And I think whatever X-Men was happening, I was like, I didn't like it. You know, the art was great. Stories were lacking, you know. And you can go back and look at what year it was. But Harbinger just started coming out. And my brother was like, oh, you got to read this. I was like, I hate superhero books. He was like, no, read, these are different. And so I picked up Harbinger, the first trade, and then Ninjak and a couple other ones. Yep. And yeah, it just blew me away. I was like, well, this is okay. The art wasn't flashy like all the other stuff that was being published at the same time, but the art was telling the story. And I kind of had that revelation where I'm like, oh, this is, it's like a good drawing doesn't make a comic book. A good comic book is good story and art that tells the story, helps the story. And I feel like those Valiant books were the antidote back then. You know, it's like the art was there to help tell the story, not to just look cool or not to just have a splash page because, you know, the drawings are nice. And then it kind of got, that was probably the last superhero books I read for a long time, because I quit everything else and I was like, well, I'll still read these because they're good. So I like XO was great, and Harbinger were probably my two favorites, and then Ninjak.
Yeah. So I gotta ask specifically around your Ninjak run. Something that really struck me, and I come from a place where I used to buy those, you know, sort of Marvel A through Z. Comics that'll give you a little background on all the characters, and they'll do like a cross section of the different weaponry and things like that. I'm reading your series of Ninjak, and I was absolutely thrilled to see that little forward in the front of each of the comics where it shows the different gadgets, because I'm also like a big James Bond fan. Gadgets, and not only that, but when you're reading about these different gadgets and what they do, there's also a psychological profile along with it. So how did that all come about?
I really wanted to do, well, I love cross sections, and I love that same stuff you're talking about. Like, yeah. I remember, like, Punisher would have, like, there'd be a special issue of Punisher War Journal or something, and it was just all of his weapons and stuff.
The Battle Van, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Joe had two G.I. Joe special missions, and then there's, like, a supplement book that had, like, the base and all the other stuff, and I love those things, you know? So I was like, oh, he has all these gadgets, I want to do those. And so I was like, let me draw those, and then I'll, you know, label them, do like all the stuff we used to love, you know?
Yeah.
And that was another one of those things where I'm like, oh, I started doing the lettering on it, and I'm like, well, this is all just made up. Like, these gadgets are kind of cool, but then if I'm labeling, it's just all made up BS, you know, like, it doesn't, what's the point of that? Like, well, what if it's something else, you know? And then maybe people won't read them because they think it's just boring, made up gadget stuff, you know? And then the people that do read it will get a little reward. it was fun. I wish I could have done it for the whole series. I just, honestly, it was an issue of time. I didn't have time to do it every single issue, or I would have.
I tell you, I would collect a book just on that, just across the Valiant universe.
You touched on it a little bit, Matt, but as far as the creative freedom you have working and building the Valiant universe now, but I've heard a lot of good things about Warren Simons, the editor. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like working with him and the creative freedom that he does give you? What's that dialogue like?
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know how else to say it. I was coming off of some other work for hire stuff that I was really frustrated by, you know, editorially. I was just like, the notes are crazy. And I was doing all these rewrites that weren't to the benefit of the story. It was for other reasons. And I was like, you know what? I'll just do my own creator own work. I don't need this. You know, like there were a few books that slipped out that with my name on them. And I was like, I wasn't happy with them not because of what I did, but because of what I was made to do, you know? And I was like, I'm never doing that again. Cause you don't, like, from the reader side, you never know. You don't know that, this story sucks because of something I didn't do. Think this sucks because I wrote it and my name's on it. I'm like, well, that's, you don't know all the background and all the, like, knowing how the sausage is made, you know. And I didn't like that. I was like, I don't want to have to explain that or have this book out that I'm not 100% proud of. So I was like, well, I'm gonna finish mine management. I'm gonna do Department H, and I'll do creator own books. I'm totally fine with it. And then I got a call from Warren. This is the order it happened in. My brother called me again. He was like, hey, you know Valiant's back, right? I was like, what? He's like, yeah. And I was like, oh, I was embarrassed because I'm in comics and I don't keep track of the business that well. He's like, yeah, yeah. And they're really good. It's just like it was, like this story driven, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I, in my iPad, and I downloaded like Bloodshot and XO. And a friend, buddy of mine, Rob, I'm friends with Rob Venditti, and he was writing XO. I was like, oh, I should read it because I'm buddies with him. So I was reading that, and I was reading Bloodshot, and I was like laughing. The Bloodshot was so violent; those first like four or five,
yeah,
it was ridiculous. I'm like, oh my god, I haven't read a comic this violent, and it was just kind of making me laugh a little bit. And I was like, this is great. And I wonder what they're going to do with his origin and the character. And I was trying to, and I was doing what I do when I read a book, where I'm like, oh, it's like I think he's going to do this, but he might do that, you know, with the origin. And I swear, a week later, after I'd read everything that had come out, Warren called me and he's like, hey, would you be interested in writing Bloodshot Zero? I was like, what? I was like, how do you know me? And he's like, XO. He had given him Mind Management like a year or two earlier, and he finally got around to reading it. And he was like, he loved Mind Management. He's like, he wanted me to do something with Valiant. I was like, oh. One issue zero, that'll be great. And so then I was like, well, what's the story? And he's like, well, you got to write it. I was like, oh, I literally was just thinking about what that story would be, because I didn't know which way the writer was going, and apparently hadn't been written yet. So I was like, well, I had this idea or that idea. And he's like, okay, great. And that first, that's not me.
That's me. Sorry.
And anyway, I was writing the first issue, and then as I was writing it, I got this. I was like, well, we'll do this, and we'll see how it is. Like, I don't know how Valiant is to work for, and I never worked with Warren before. And we'll just try him out and see what it's like. And then I wrote the issue. It was great. I got a couple notes. It were all good notes to make the story better, and it was fantastic. And then afterwards, Warren, I realized.
Sorry about
Warren
that.
Warren was trying me out just to see what I was like to work with, you know? And then I told him later, I was like, Warren, I was trying you out to see what you were like. I didn't necessarily need the work. I want to have fun, you know? And then it was just tons of comics after that, you know? I think Warren's probably one of the smartest editors I've ever worked with. You know, all the notes he's given me have always been notes to help the story or, you know, just ideas or things to think about. And if I don't agree with it, I don't do it. You know, there's been a few things where I'm like, oh, I don't know. And he's like, oh, well then don't do it. So he's been a dream to work with. It really is. He's the reason I've done as much with Valiant. Cool. That's that story. But anyway, he's great.
So, the new, XO Manowar, I guess I'm a huge fan of the sort of reluctant gunslinger story. And at the beginning of the story, I mean, he looks like he's kind of retired from his adventuring, and he's with his best gal, and he doesn't want anything to do more with these crazy, you know, adventures, etc. And then he gets pulled back in to this story. So do you... I guess where did that sort of come from in terms of, you know, did you feel that he was just sort of compelled to do this? He did not want to continue on with his these adventures, or is it just sort of his destiny to continue on with these?
Yeah, I think it was a couple things. One is Providence is a long, good run on EXO. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know, follow that up. I don't want to follow that up. And he asked me if I wanted to. And I was like, well, I got to think of an idea. I don't know. I want to do something different, something that's true to the character. And so that's my thought was to do that is like, well, I kind of wanted to isolate Eric again and sort of make him to figure out what he is like without, if you take the armor away, what kind of a character is he? And then the kind of character he is something that is really good at fighting, you know?
Yeah.
And he may not like it, but that's what he's good at. And so it was fun to sort of like pull the armor off of him and make him a character that, you know, if you didn't have the armor on, you could still recognize him and you'd still kind of, you know, be excited to see him.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of those things, like ever since I was a kid, I always hated the superhero movies or the monster movies where it's like 20 minutes in, I haven't seen the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
Where is he? You know? so I hate that feeling. So I was trying to do that is give us EXO, but not let you have that feeling of like, where's the armor? Come on. Like, when's he start blasting, you know, and try to make it fun, without that, you know, and then slowly reintroduce the armor. And then, you know, the rest of the series is sort of investigating like his relationship with the armor and the armor is sort of mild spoiler has become kind of sentient, you know, so he has conversations with it. And I think that introducing the armor as not just the thing he wears and uses, but as like a character in the book to sort of create conflict and interest. That was sort of the thing. I'm like, oh, I can do this. And that's something that doesn't like tread on ground that Rob covered already. And kind of gives it something new. And then we get to be on an alien planet with a lot of weird, you know,
working with an artist like, Tomas Giorello, who I think he's perfectly suited for the book because you're kind of setting up Eric kind of he is naturally a barbarian, right? Like a Conan, and Thomas comes from drawing Conan. How much does it get your creative juices?
Oh.
Sorry, I cut out for a second.
Yeah, I think it cut up.
Yeah, yeah, you saw the art. That it's amazing.
It is amazing.
I think that was the other thing. Like I'm a huge Conan fan. And I always wanted to do something like that also. So this is sort of a perfect opportunity to hide my Conan story I wanted to tell in something different. and getting him to draw it was a bonus.
Oh, I think Anthony's coming back. So you said you're a big Conan. I'm also a huge Conan fan, so I took to this character right away. I'll be honest. Like when I first started reading The Valiant back in the '90s, I thought, well, this is sort of derivative of an Iron Man, right? That's just on the surface, right? And then I find out this is not Iron Man.
Yeah, that's what. It's that twist. That twist of having the barbarian in the suit is it makes it great, you know. Otherwise, you look at the cover, it looks like Iron Man, but then you read it and you're like, oh, it's completely different, you know.
So I'm just going to try to get Eric back here. Okay, great. Okay, so moving on to some of the other Valiant. Going back to The Valiant. So Eternal Warrior, again, I think I was reading a few of these comics back in the '90s as well. Eternal Warrior was my favorite. And I think back to something you said, it's almost as if you could go anywhere with this character because he is eternal. I mean, at least on the planet. But when I read The Valiant, I found it it was a fantastic story. But in a way, it was a little bit depressing because I kept thinking this guy is just fighting a losing battle. And what is motivating this guy? Like, what did you feel that is motivating this guy to continue to do this throughout eternity?
I think it's kind of his duty, and I think it's one of those things. I think it's one of those things where he's interesting because he doesn't really die, right? So,
right.
Yeah. It's like, why would you? What keeps you going at all? Like,
yeah.
Where's your? There's no motivation to. Where's the urgency? You know. But I think he has a duty to protect this geomancer, you know, and he's just going to do it, you know, and I think that was my favorite part. Like the nerd in me was excited to do, to tell the story of how he got his scars. Cause he's had those forever. Right.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
And I asked, and I liked Eternal Warrior back then too. But I wasn't sure. I was like, did we ever tell the story of his scars? And they're like, no. It's like, oh, this is great. It's like, I love the idea of this bad guy that's like keeping score on his face, you know? And I'm like, it's like that, I think that would make him angry, you know? It's like, he wants to stop getting those, you know?
So
it's like, try to do that. So I guess that's pretty much it. And he is, I think as a grown up now, he's probably the character I am most excited about because you could tell a story in any time, any place with him.
Right.
You know, it's the thing with like Sandman where it's like, he's the perfect background tell any story you want to tell.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I really took it. And I guess you're really putting with all these sort of historical pieces in the Valiant universe, you're putting your imprint right across the Valiant universe with things such as, you know, telling the story of when he got his scars and that'll always be there. So you're putting that that imprint.
That's what makes me nervous. Don't.
Boy, I think you're doing a great job. So Divinity is another one. So Divinity actually really took me by surprise. And Eric will tell you, Eric and I have been championing the new Valiant run. We've almost rediscovered it again. And there's just something so fresh with this company. There's something, it feels that they're really taking care of their fans. And this Divinity comic really took me by surprise. I didn't know anything about it going into this. And I actually did not even realize it was an origin story until the end of the comic. So I'd really like to sort of hear a little bit of the background. What inspired you to write this? Where did this idea come from?
Yeah, it's really funny, but I was driving to Heroes Con a couple of years ago, I guess before the first arc came out, and I got a call from Warren, and he's like, "Hey Matt, I got an idea for a new story." I was like, "All right, what is it?" He was like, "It's called Divinity," and I was like, "Oh," I was like, "Okay, what's the idea?" He was like, "That's it. I just got the
that's it."
I was like, "What are you calling me for?" and we just sort of laughed about it and everything. I was like, "Oh, okay," and then hung up. And then drove to Heroes, and it kind of was in the back of my mind. And on the way back from Heroes, I was thinking about it, and I was talking to my friend Brian Hurt. We carpool every year, and I was telling him, like, I got this funny phone call about this, and then I started brainstorming in the car, and I got this idea for this character. And then all that stuff, like in the car ride, I had most of it figured out by the time we got home. And I wrote it all down and I emailed Warren. I was like, "Hey Warren, here's an idea. here's the rest of your idea." and then that was it. And it was odd to me because I always felt like Valiant, they had this core group of characters. There was some characters at the time, even there were characters that hadn't really been launched yet or we hadn't gotten to, and I was like, "Do you really want a new character already? Like, why? There's so many superheroes. There's so many characters in the whole world. And then even in the Valiant universe, we haven't gotten to all the ones that people are like dying to see, you know?" So I like the story. I'd love to tell it,
yeah.
You know, but are you sure that it's, you know, marketable or people are going to care? You know, it's not EXO. It's not Shadow Man. People are begging to have Shadow Man back. And then we're going to give him this new character no one has heard of or cares about. They're like, "Yeah, don't worry about that." I was like, "Okay, yeah." I mean, I'm not really worried. I'm worried for you guys. I'm fine telling this story because I think it's going to be fun and cool. But And so then the story came out and it did so well. And I was like, I don't understand. I guess I don't understand the comic book industry, you know, and I think that the Valiant readers, maybe I didn't give enough credit because I felt like the readers were made up of people that were either fans back in the 90s or, and then we're just buying this again, you know, but it's more than that. I think there are people have found the Valiant books again, and they're open to characters that weren't around back then because they just want good stories, you know, and it didn't really matter. And it was a new one. It was weird. It was different than the other books in the line. And I guess that's why it did well, but it totally shocked me.
Was it, why choose the Cold War as a starting point?
Oh boy, I'm trying to think of the evolution of why. And I think I wanted to do Cosmonaut. And I wanted to do like one of the first people in space, you know, and throw them up there. And I think that's really the only reason. I'm trying to remember the origin of the idea. A lot of times I can remember specifically, but that one, I don't know. I think that was it. I think I just wanted to do something. I wanted to do something with a Russian, and in the 60s and the Cold War, it seemed like a natural place to start the story. I don't know. I'm a fan of that era.
Yeah, and this particular character, you know, very godlike, I guess similar to the Sandman characters in a way. I guess this lends you to a very open, an open book. You could pretty much take this anywhere.
Yeah, that's what. It was one of those. He's one of those characters that it's kind of tricky. It's almost like Superman, where he's so powerful. How do you tell an interesting story with a character that can't ever be in danger? You know, and it can basically do anything. And I think with Superman, a lot of times what happens is you get a story that's not about Superman. So I was trying to avoid that and try to do a story that is really grounded in about this, really humanize this character that has these abilities, but make it about him. You know, it's not about something else. It's not about his newspaper pal that's in trouble and he has to save him. It's about him, you know, and about what makes him tick and how he's got all this power, but then what limits him, you know, like how his emotions and how his history limits what he will do or what he can do, you know, even though he, you know, potentially could do anything. And I think that was what was interesting about the character to me, is to make it a real person and make it this kid that grew up in Russia and was a fan of sci-fi books. And that sort of informed what he turned into later and his imagination, how his power manifests itself.
Guys, I'm back. Sorry for disappearing on you. My computer decided to malfunction for a little bit. What did I miss? You got to catch me up on everything. Matt, repeat everything you said.
All right. Okay.
So we talked a little about divinity and the Valiant.
Okay. I missed your answer. Did anybody hear the question I asked about Tom Giorello? Was that eliminated? Or did it?
No, I did. I heard it. And I said he's awesome.
Okay.
These pages come in and they're the coolest because they are.
Yeah, they're amazing.
It made me want to just write like action scene after action scene, you know, full of dudes fighting each other.
Yeah, but being the artist, you also have that, I guess, sympathy to know like, okay, I can't be cruel and make him do all this stuff because if I was in that position, you know, I'd hate it. But he's I guess up for the challenge, so that's great. So. Question I have in regards to, again, Valiant, obviously you guys have great creative teams. Like I was asleep at the wheel for a long time seeing Valiant on the shelf, thinking it was just another upstart comic book publisher. But last year at the Toronto Fan Expo, one of the sales reps held a panel and I decided to check it out. And seeing the creative teams from yourself, Rob Venditti, Jeff Lemire, and then all the artists, Carrie Nord, Clay Mann, It's important to the acclaim and success that you guys are having because all your books are critically acclaimed. But from a publishing company aspect, what really separates it from the other big two publishers that have a contained universe? There's something different about Valiant. I don't know if I could put my finger on it. I wonder if you can kind of, extrapolate it for me.
Yeah, I think at least from my own perspective, you know, I don't know all the goings-ons and how all the creative teams work, but I do know that I've worked with all the companies, and I know that my working relationship with the artists I work with is how I work with people on my own creator books. Like I'm doing a book, Ether, with David Rubin, with Dark Horse, and it's just us, you know. And I treat the artists I work with at Bally the same way I treat him. It's like, what do you like to draw? Like, what kinds of things are you interested in? You know, when I was doing Rye with Clayton Crane, I would talk to him on the phone, you know, and I talked to Warren. I was like, hey, Warren, is it all right if I, can I just talk to Clayton? Cause it's weird not to talk to the artists, you know? And mm-hmm. I think a lot of, depending on the publisher and the editor, like they discourage it sometimes. And I'm like, that's completely counterintuitive to how comics should be made. Cause it's the writing and the art together that make it good. And so I remember that was one of the earliest collaborations I'd had at Valiant. I talked to Clayton. I was like, well, what kind of stuff are you interested in? What do you like to draw? And apparently he likes to draw vehicles. And
I was like, and horses?
I wouldn't. We'll draw horses too. He likes animals and everything. And I'm like, all the stuff I don't. I'm like, well, I'll keep that in mind then, because normally my brain just edits all that stuff out of a script. I'm only half kidding, because it is, I think that's what the difference is like when the writers are working with these artists, you know, it's not just a job or a paycheck, you know, cause you could, these guys are all really talented, you know, they could get work at Marvel or DC in a heartbeat, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's not about that. It's about the working relationship, you know, and like having some input, you know, and feeling like a collaborator rather than just a production artist. I think that's the big difference, you know, and I think that's why the books read better and look better is just because it's everybody working together rather than just one person doing this and another person doing that and no one really communicating.
The big two right now, they're constantly doing a lot of restarts, renumbering, you know, every year there's back to number one, and I'm getting so frustrated with it. But in the case of Valiant, I really appreciate the fact that a Harbinger can go 1 to 25 and then you get, you know, Harbinger Renegade, or now your take on Exo Manowar. Why do you think, I mean, I know you don't have the answer, but why do you think it works in the Valiant model and everybody's sick of, you know, the big corporations that are constantly doing it? What do you think the biggest differences are?
Yeah, I think honestly I don't read that other stuff, so I can't speak to what it is, you know, exactly. I do see it happening, and people, I think that's a really common complaint. But what I like about how Valiant handles it is that it's all story driven, you know, the stories end because that's the end of the story, not because, oh, we got to fill six more issues or we got to go to 25. Like when I ended Ninjak, I was like, that's all I got. Like I had a plan from the beginning. I was like, this is what I've got, you know, and I would rather, then just keep spinning it out or whatever. I had an ending. I was like, let me do that. And then there's enough material in there and branches of the story that someone else can explore. But I feel like it's always a natural break. It's not like, oh, we're going to do six issues and we got to relaunch. It's always, I always give a pitch, and my pitch is, you know, it's like a year's worth of comics, or, you know, with Ninjak, it was maybe 2 or 3 years up front I had an idea for. And Exo, definitely the same thing. It's like a year, I have the first year and a half planned out. And after that, I'm not sure, you know, something may grow out of it. And if it doesn't, then it'll end, you know. And then it makes its own story. So you could read mine, and you wouldn't need to read Rob's arc. Or you could read all of Rob's arc and then read mine. They still fit together. But I think it's just because the marketing is driven by the content and it's driven by the story. It's not the other way around. It's not like, hey, we got to have six books this month, or we got to have we got to fill a trade. The story never starts like that. The story always starts with what's the idea, you know, and then it comes out of that.
It's story driven, not marketing driven.
Exactly. And it's so great, because then it's so fun to see what they do with the marketing side of it. You know, it's the marketing never comes first. And then you're doing the story, and then all of a sudden I see these covers coming out, and like they're promoting it, and there's a logo, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's really cool. Somebody was thinking about it, you know? So I get a real kick out of seeing that stuff happen afterwards, which isn't always, I don't think other companies always do that. I think sometimes the marketing or the space that needs to be filled comes first, and then somebody fills it.
Are you excited for the live action projects that are coming up? Like, to see your imprint on those?
Yeah, I saw some footage from one of the Ninjak. They're doing those webisodes, and then there's a couple of scenes with Roku with the long hair and everything. I was like, oh, that's weird. I'm created that character, and yeah. It's cool to see her like running around, and so that was odd in a good way. It was weird. It's fun. I'm excited. I'm a nerd like everybody else. These books, you know, I'm just as excited to see it all.
So can you tell us a little bit? You're working on Ninjak Shadowman Rapture. I don't know if you guys touched on that at all. Can you give us a little bit of what to expect from that book and what it's about?
Yeah, this came from an idea for part of the Dead Side, because I had Ninjak going to the Dead Side a lot in Ninjak. And I was. It was always really fun because he hated the Dead Side. So it was fun to put it. And I had this idea with the Dead Side. I'm like, well, if there's I guess I've had this idea for a while where you always see, like, even in the Marvel books, they would go to hell or whatever, and then Mephisto's down there or something. And then with the Dead Side, it was the same where it's like, well, we had this creepy, horrible place. But then, like, where's the good? Isn't there a good one? Like, isn't there a good place you could go to have an adventure? So I wanted to do that. I was like, I wanted there to be like a mission to go to the alive side, you know, where's the alive side? And so that's kind of what it's about. It's about, this villain sort of figuring out a way to break into it, you know, and then a couple of our characters going along with him or following him there. And then sort of that. So it's Shadow Man who deserves to be on the Dead Side because that's, he just makes sense there, and then Ninjak because it's funny to put him there. He hates it, and then Tama, who was the girl from the Valiant, the Geomancer. I wanted to do something with her since the Valiant. Like Jeff and I, when we were doing that, had an idea for stories with her and her character, and we just never got to it. You know, it just didn't make sense in with the other stuff we were doing. So that's why the first issue opens up with 8 pages of just her walking through the Dead Side having an adventure, because I wanted to sort of establish her and what she's about and sort of make her a character that people would be excited about. You know, I don't know if she'll ever get her own book. Like, I would love to do a book that's just her. So hopefully people will read that and be like, oh yeah, more of her.
I'd love to read it. That'd be great.
Absolutely. Did you guys talk about The Valiant at all? Did we get into that book?
Yeah, we touched on it a little bit, but
okay. Just checking. So officially, is it Ninjak or Ninja K? What's the official name?
I call him Ninjak.
All right. If you call him Ninjak, I'm calling him Ninjak too.
Okay.
Sounds good. So my last question is, I know it's not going to be happening this year, but are there any plans for you possibly to be coming to a Toronto Comic Con or Fan Expo in the future? Because that would be awesome to have you here.
I need to get up there. I've been trying to take a year off or not do a show twice in 2 times in a row. And but man, I haven't been to Toronto forever. I used to go to TCAP every year.
Oh.
And then I kind of whatever, other shows have gotten in the way, or it's right around my daughter's birthday, and then or Mother's Day. It's always on like Mother's Day. So it's always a little weird to get there. But what's the other one? The big one is
Fan Expo. They hold it on the long weekend just before kids go back to school, and then the Toronto Comic Con is usually held in March.
Yeah, so one of those I will go to next year. I don't know which one yet, but yeah, I gotta get back up to Toronto. I'm friends with Jeff, so every time I go, I stay with him, and then we hang out, and that's like, you know, quality time.
That's awesome. Well, I'd be great to have you up here. I checked this year on the list, even when they were having the updates. I'm like, oh man, no, I can't. But the Valiant boys will be coming here, which is going to be exciting because I love going to their booth and being able to see the stock of everything there to pick from, because the Rye hardcover is no longer available to get anymore. I'm so bummed out. Yeah, it's already It's all soft cover now, but those Valiant hardcovers are beautiful. The deluxe editions are beautiful collections, and they're definitely worth the price. Great price point for them too.
Yeah, no, they're good. I take all the dust jackets off and put them on my shelf because I like the shiny foil.
Yeah.
On there, I think it looks cooler.
Yeah, I keep showing Eric that I did get one.
Yeah, he keeps reminding me and sending me pictures. Yeah, it's like $270 now on Amazon. It's very depressing.
Oh, yeah, so I'll have to look through my studio. If I find an extra one, I'll send it to you. I don't know what I got left.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Thanks.
Any other questions, Mr. Slam Duncan?
I think Matt's been very generous with his time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Matt, for fitting us into your schedule, knowing how busy you are, man.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate it. Thanks for the good questions.
Awesome. Look forward to reading all your creator-owned and upcoming Valiant stuff. Keep up the good work.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right.
Cheers.
All right. See ya.
Well, folks, there you have it, our conversation with Matt Kint. It was a lot of fun to be able to talk to him from as long as we did. I just want to say thanks to Matt once again for being so generous with his time, as well as to his family, seeing how busy his schedule is. So time is of the essence, right? It's a real precious thing. So when you get to talk to some of the people that you're a big fan of, it's a real treat. And I just want to once again express my thanks and gratitude to him. Don't forget to check us out at thecaveofsolitude.com or caveofsolitude@outlook.com to leave an email. Subscribe on iTunes to our podcast. Leave a review if you can. It helps get the word out and get other people to listen to our show as well. And don't forget to check out my buddy Slam Duncan's podcast, The Fastball Special. Leave a review as well as subscribe to that one. We got good content for you guys, and it's, you know, entertaining shows and conversations that you can feel like you're a part of. Honestly, we welcome the feedback. We want to hear from the people who are listening to our shows and include them in our shows as well. Thank you once again for listening. I am Eric Anthony of the Cave of Solitude, and we will see you soon.